In 1970 cinema, particularly from America, there was a slew of revenge films, with one particular strand being the vigilante thriller, which depicted citizens taking the law into their own hands in response to spiralling crime rates, characterised by films such as Taxi Driver, Rolling Thunder and Death Wish. Added to this were a number of rogue cop films, where police officers broke the rules to catch criminals who had escaped liberal justice systems, of which Dirty Harry is one of the most notable. Dr. Kerry Edwards of Boston College and the University of Derby has a new book out this month from Bloomsbury entitled The Vigilante Thriller: Violence, Spectatorship and Identification in American Cinema from 1970 to 1976, which contextualises the American vigilante film. And he joins me today to discuss his new book and the films that it's based on. Kerry, thanks very much for showing up today and agreeing to do this podcast. Can you tell us what prompted your research and maybe just a little bit about the synopsis of the book?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's in many ways, it started actually with watching Straw Dogs. And if there's one film that sparked this off, it was watching Straw Dogs, and it was going, I think I enjoyed that, and I have no idea what I think of it. I don't know what I think about the characters. I don't know what I think about Dustin Hoffman's character particularly. And then I started reading, and then I started to see connections between a cycle of movies that shook up certainly the critics, the mainstream American critics at the time, and they're all engaging with Law and Order. So I started to look into it, and I found a sort of a series of films that the critics at the time were lumping together. So we start with Joe, which is a slightly more obscure film directed by John G. Avildsen from 1970, made by Canon Films, but not 1980s Canon Films, before the Go-Go Boys, Golan and Globus were involved. Then French Connection, Dirty Harry, Death Wish and Taxi Driver all sort of got sucked in, because they're all fundamentally reactions to what's going on in America at the time. And one of the things that the book is kind of in two halves. The first half is really about context, and it looks at the cinematic context, the reaction, but also some of the political and social context. And a lot of it is actually to do with the end of sort of meta-narrative or grand narrative, whatever you want to call it, and the crisis of meaning that's going on in America. And these movies come out and they sort of draw from the Western and they draw from the police thriller. But the critics at the time, and actually subsequently, really think they have settled ideological positions. And I was watching them thinking, I don't think these films are that settled. I think they're actually, there's alternate ways of reading these things. And so the second half of the book is me looking at the films from, you know, spectatorship theory positions and going, actually, if we start opening these texts up, they are way more complicated than I think they were given credit for. Is to go back to these films that had a very settled critical reaction, particularly the sort of the first few, which are Taxi Driver is slightly different, but certainly, you know, Dirty Harry, Death Wish, these are right-wing films. These are just violent, you know, cathartic fantasies for white guys enjoying people shooting black guys or whatever. And I was looking at thinking, actually, I think it's way more complicated than that. And that's really what the book's about. It's exploring that and trying to work out why the films happened then, and revisiting them anew and trying to open them up as texts rather than sort of this settled ideological reading that I think has dominated, you know, for the past 50 years.
Would you say the settled ideological reading of these films is more to do with the films themselves, or maybe just the way that discourse happens now online? We need a settled reading because we need to sum it up in, you know, 140 characters or something like that. What do you kind of thought about that?
It's really interesting that, because I think a lot about this, because when the book was going through process, I was one of my readers sort of suggested that maybe I should draw parallels to modern politics, and I didn't, because it would be very easy, but I'm always wary of using the past as a lens to discuss today. One of the big things, though, is the internet has supercharged everything. In the 1970s, when the films came out, there is a settled discourse, and it's dominated by certain mainstream film critics who are way more powerful than critics are today. I guess something like Rotten Tomatoes maybe has some sort of power like that. But you're thinking of your Pauline Kaels, your Richard Schickels, your Andrew Saris types. And they are really setting a sort of a narrative image, an idea of the movies that comes across, that is a reaction as much to the political upheaval of the time as it is, I think, the movies. So they're reading into the films their personal, you know, sort of anxieties and worries. And this was, you know, this is the early 70s. This is a scary time in a lot of respects. You look at the crime statistics, and the rising crime statistics are really staggering in America. And New York is falling apart. I mean, the bin men are on strike half the time. The city's running out of money. I mentioned the Fear City pamphlet that the police came, you know, put out in what I think 75, 76, saying basically, don't come to New York, you'll get mugged, raped, or murdered. And so the movies are sort of a part of that discourse, but I think there's always worth detaching a movie and just looking at it as it is, and then looking at the discourse and saying, okay, how do these things interact? Because they're not exactly the same thing. And of course, we've got distance, critical distance of time to be able to go in with slightly fresher eyes. Whereas if you queued up to see Death Wish in 1974 and you're in a New York cinema and everybody's cheering Charles Bronson as he shoots people, you're going to start to worry about these things, which, you know, is an understandable reaction, but perhaps an oversimplification of how the audience understands cinema.
I think coming from Wolverhampton or England generally, it would be difficult to imagine what it would be like to go and watch a film that's set literally outside the door of the cinema that you're actually watching it in, right? Especially if you're watching a film in a cinema and there's all this chaos that's supposed to be going on a couple of blocks down the road whilst you're watching it in a cinema in the middle of New York.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And look, there were good reports from the time of the interaction of the audiences, particularly with Death Wish, because Death Wish really worried a lot of people. And there were news reports in The Guardian in the UK about the people watching Death Wish and what does this mean? And does that mean we're becoming like America and all these sorts of things? The fears that it would, you know, inspire people to start riding the subway and shooting down people, which it didn't do. We might talk about Bernie Goetz later, but it didn't do it. So it's different. It is always different. It's interesting. I teach This Is England is one of the films I do with my students, which is a fab film. And it is actually filmed locally, bits of it, to where we are. So when they're driving, and you can see it really does resonate more because you go, yeah, I know that road, or that looks like where I live. And it does have that connection. So yeah, absolutely. I think the immediacy, the resonance, but also the media saturation at the time of crime. And, you know, it was a moral panic. It was a hot button issue. There's commentary about that in Straw Dogs because Straw Dogs is slightly anomalous because it's set in the UK, but it's still very much a movie about America. And of course, the locals tease Dustin Hoffman's character, David Sumner, about all the violence in America and that they see on TV. But of course, it's also in Death Wish with the media exploitation of the vigilante actions throughout the movie, which is a very interesting commentary within Death Wish that I think, you know, deserves more attention, actually.
So maybe before we go any further, could you tell me what you think the differences are between a vigilante film and the revenge thriller? And I know these cross over. And I've got a sense of what I think is the distinction between these two terms.
Yeah, it's to do with the target of what you're doing. This is what I think. So the vigilante thriller targets the sort of nature of crime more widely, whereas a revenge thriller would target an individual specifically. Now, I get annoyed with people about Death Wish because Death Wish is often described as a revenge film. But he makes absolutely no effort to go anywhere near the people who murdered his wife and raped his daughter. He's not interested in finding them. What he does is he goes around, it's not like flirting. I'm trying to remember, there's a good Velvet Light Trap article about this, and I can't remember exactly the wording, but it's basically, I'm going to go out there, and he baits muggers to attack him, and then he shoots them. But it's not a revenge thing because there is no finality to that. There's no catharsis in that. And at the end of the movie, he just moves to Chicago and is going to go and shoot people. I know the sequels come later and don't follow that up, but it's open-ended. So vigilantism is about a greater problem, the crime problem more generally, whereas a revenge film is a personally motivated goal, which is finite. It can be completed in the narrative.
Thank you. So your films, your book covers from about 1970 to about 1976. And you start off looking at a film called the aforementioned Joe by John G. Avildsen. Tell us something about why you picked 1970 to 1976, why you picked that film. I definitely know there's vigilante films that come after 1976. But what about the ones that come beforehand? Why is 1970 as the start point?
It was particularly because, I mean, the vigilante film basically has its origins in the Western. That's you know, it goes back to the Western. And what I saw Joe as, and 1971 in very quick succession, you get Straw Dogs, Dirty Harry, and The French Connection as well, is the beginning of a sort of transferal to a more urban setting, a more modern setting, and a deliberate interaction with the moral panic about violence at the time in those settings. And again, like I say, Straw Dogs, I know, is in Cornwall, but it does interact with these things. So I looked at that, and I was looking back, and it's all tied up to the new Hollywood revolution as well, because we have the end of the motion picture code in 68, the move to the Cara system. So in a sense, these films had to kind of start happening then, because we couldn't depict things like that. And one of the things they do is they bring some of the, I guess, sublimated issues of the Western to the fore. So, you know, a lot of Westerns imply rape. That's clearly an anxiety. It comes from the Puritan captivity narrative, which is, you know, 200 years old. And they play with that, whether these films can suddenly actually depict these things. So I just looked at the films that came slightly before, and they weren't as directly dealing with breaking from the law as these films were. So films like Madigan or Bullet or Coogan's Bluff, with, you know, which is a little bit of a dry run for Dirty Harry, but not quite. They're still generally working within the confines of the badge, whereas these are either you have cops who are going outside of the badge, you know, and Dirty Harry throws his away at the end, or we're starting to just take ordinary people and develop them. That's why I started there. I finish with Taxi Driver because I think that's kind of the artistic cultural peak of this cycle. After that, there are some really good movies like Rolling Thunder, for instance, that don't get the mainstream reaction and panic that the cycle did. And so I'm looking at that sort of panic. By the time Taxi Driver, we kind of codified and defined this, and then we moved on and we'll panic about something else. Although in the 80s, we start panic about videotapes. So The Exterminator, which I know you've talked about in your podcast, and The Exterminator 2 and Miss 45 and those sorts of things. But they're more of a sort of a videotape inspired cheaper grindhouse. I mean, other than Joe, these are all pretty, you know, well-made Hollywood movies. So I wanted to look at that impact. And I did exclude a few films. I excluded Walking Tall, which is more sort of set in a Western milieu, but also didn't have the mainstream reaction. And there was Billy Jack, and I really toyed with Billy Jack as well, because it's often held up as sort of left liberal vigilante film, if such a thing is entirely possible. But again, I wanted to look at the texts that I thought were less ideologically coherent, which is something that comes up a lot. And I think that's at the heart of this cycle, which makes it slightly different, is that they aren't settled, despite what critics at the time thought they were.
What's this is maybe the next big question, is what are the distinctions here? You've got the kind of rogue cop of Dirty Harry. One of the other films that you look at is The French Connection, but the others are kind of citizen vigilantes, right? So what's the distinction between these?
Well, I mean, I grouped them together. One, like I said, the contemporary reaction grouped them together. So I thought that was really interesting. A lot of people lumped them together and said these are part of the same movement. So let's question that. They're all grappling with the individual in the face of a breakdown of the social order. For films that are often accused of being fascist, and I talk about this, they're actually individualistic films, which doesn't, you know, fascism is a collective ideology, collectivist ideology. These are actually about the sort of the nature of the individual faced with these insurmountable problems. And that's a tie within all of them. None of the endings of these films really solve anything, which is something I draw a lot of attention to. You know, Dirty Harry, okay, he stops Scorpio, throws his badge away, crime's still a thing. You know, French Connection actually completely undoes everything they achieved. Those end titles just ruin it. Straw Dogs, he buggers off. He drives away. He leaves his wife. He leaves the home. Everything that he's supposed to have, you know, fought for. Joe has a character killing his own daughter by accident. Taxi Driver is a really interesting ending. It's been interpreted, I think it's Amy Torban who's interpreted it as a dream. That actually he's dead and it could be a dream. But again, it asks serious questions about how society reacts. And, you know, Death Wish, he's just going to go and kill people in Chicago, clearly. So that sort of unsettledness was an important aspect of that.
Is that part of this? Because we've got the kind of cop thing, that the rogue cop, you know, is obviously clearly something different to the citizen, as the citizen doing this. The Citizen, I guess, hints. I mean, all those films really, particularly Dirty Harry and The Citizen Vigilantes, they hint at, I guess, the lack of confidence in law and order, maybe.
Yeah.
French Connection maybe does that in a far more subtle way, I think.
Yes, because it shows you the workings of it. I'm always fascinated that The French Connection got less critical opprobrium than Dirty Harry. In fact, I wrote about that in, I've got a chapter in a book called New Wave, New Hollywood, which was edited by Nathan Abrams and Greg Frame, came out in October, and I talk about that. There's interesting sort of interaction with the question of law and order and the breakdown of law and order and the breakdown of institutions. We've also got a period where policing changed profoundly in the late 60s because they brought in the rights of the suspect. They brought in Miranda rights after the custody hearing around Ernesto Miranda and the treatment of him and in the police. And so we got the, you know, that you have the right to remain silent came in. And this created huge tensions and furore about the limits of policing power and how far are the police allowed to go. And all the films sort of draw attention to either really the impotence of law and order as an institution, maybe not as an individual, but as an institution. So yeah, the end of French Connection. I mean, did they achieve anything really? In fact, you have to watch the sequel. They advertise French Connection 2, as you've seen the first one, now watch the climax. Because they know that there's no ending to the French Connection. So they sold the sequel on. And of course, the sequel sort of answers it and resolves it in a way that the first one never does. So you have this really interesting tension because the left mistrusts the police at the time because it's jack-booted guys who are beating you. But the right aren't happy with the police because they don't feel like they're protecting anybody. So it's a real point of tension at the times, you know, again, the ideological struggle comes up.
I wonder if there's anything, again, this idea of the fact that it's the cop and the citizen differences, the fact that you've got Straw Dogs in there, but that's an English influence, whether that brings in that's part of the ideological looseness, maybe?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's a reflection of the ideological confusion of the times, that these films, like I say, aren't settled and don't really know. I'm not sure that they know what they're saying because they never resolve themselves. So we go back to Todorov, and I talk about Todorov. I know it's old school, but you know the point of narrative is to offer ideological closure. That ideological closure really tells you what the story is about, what it means. We have no ideological closure in most of these movies. It just isn't neat. It asks more questions. And so I think that's something, again, that ties them together. There's sort of a refusal to just go and say, this is what this means. And that's indicative kind of of new Hollywood. I mean, that's, you know, there's a lot of movies like that. But there's doing it, you know, kind of in the action genre and, you know, engaging with this law and order idea as well.
I wonder whether part of it is a lot of these kind of late 60s into the 70s films, they start to kind of play around with form and the kind of like the especially based around the kind of the new wave influence. So I think, I wonder whether there's what you get in things like a lot of these movies is freeze frames towards the end. I know in Joe you get the freeze frames when some of the you get shot at the end, and I wonder whether I don't know whether the breakdowns in form again contribute to these uncertainties of the ideologies, uncertainties of the meanings. The uncertainty prompts the form, or the form prompts the uncertainty, or whether it's inadvertent and it's just they're playing stylistic games. I'd have to go in and revisit some of these.
I think with Joe, they're playing stylistic games because it's a low budget movie and they're throwing everything at the wall. And when I talk about spectatorship with Joe, I actually think there's quite a lot of moments in Joe that are quite distancing because they draw attention to the form of the film quite overtly. When the Bill Compton character, the dad character, kills the hippie Frank, it's absolutely over stylized. So it just reminds you that, you know, you're watching a movie and it throws you out. I think audiences are pretty canny on that. I think sometimes we don't give them enough credit that audiences do know they're watching a movie quite often, that they're not just sutured into this disavowal of reality and that they're sucked into it. And, you know, I talk to my students about this, but you go to a movie and, you know, you're only 2 seconds from somebody opening a packet of crisps and ruining the diegesis. So it's more complicated than that. But it is a time of experimentation in form. And of course, that comes from the influence of, you know, the French New Wave and whatever, but also the breakdown of the studio system. So you have filmmakers who are willing to break form. But of course, the studio system was also a moral framework. So they're breaking that at the same time. So they kind of go in lockstep. And it's difficult to work out, you know, okay, are we breaking ideology? Are we breaking form? Are we breaking everything? And how much they're thinking about that as well. You know, how self-conscious that is, which is certainly self-conscious in Taxi Driver, because, you know, that's the sort of director Scorsese is. With Michael Winner in Death Wish, maybe that's less self-conscious because he's not that sort of director.
So in terms of that, you mentioned things like the idea of the end of a, this is in your synopsis for the book, the kind of the end of the idea of grand narratives, you know, the crisis in meaning, shifting meaning of the other.
Yeah.
What prompts this in American society now? I'm not the expert you are on this. You know, how much is Vietnam important to this, or is that just bubbling under there in the background?
You can't ignore it because it's there. The grand narrative I really talk about is the Western, and you know, a lot of people at the time, particularly with Death Wish and Dirty Harry, and I talk about this, draw. You know, these are urban Westerns. A lot of these films got described. And Taxi Driver is often seen as to be modeled on The Searchers in some ways, which is really interesting. So we have a foundational narrative for America, the manifest destiny narrative. And it has at its center the white male frontiersman. He's the hero. Well, the problem is we start discovering that that's wrong. Partly we get Vietnam and we start to see the farm boy who was the Audie Murphy hero, you know, well, he's out there doing my life. So we're losing faith in that. We're also, you know, revising America's own history of itself, and Native American rights are coming up. So suddenly all those movies where, you know, Red Indians, as they were called at the time, are being shot. Suddenly this starts to look like genocide. So the foundation myth of America is being unpicked. What do these movies do is they respond to that. Vietnam's absolutely part of that. The political upheaval, the civil rights movement, they're all absolutely unpicking a sort of mythological fabric of American society. Now, the other is a really important part of that because we define ourselves by the other. We define good against, you know, the other. And these movies really struggle with those concepts because it's not clear. I'll say Dirty Harry. There is distinct paralleling between Harry and Scorpio. They are very deliberately shown to have a lot of similarities and some very telling differences. But there's a desire to blur the lines between the hero and the psychotic villain there and suggest they're pretty similar. One of the advertising taglines for Dirty Harry was, you know, the hero cop and the psycho killer, you know, the hero's the one with the badge. And it's like drawing our attention to that. These are neurotic, obsessional characters. You know, Doyle, Popeye Doyle in The French Connection is a massive obsessive. with an interesting line in fetishistic sex that never really gets quite talked about, but the fact that he's handcuffed to a bed at one point and he's constantly chasing women who wear boots. There was interesting, there was a scene cut out the French Connection, which would have had Frog 2, Nikolai, in an S&M scenario, which would have made a parallel between them really evident, but it got cut out, which is a shame, so we can't talk about it. Joe, audiences reacted depending on who they were. So it was a hugely popular film. It kind of got forgotten, but we're talking about it now, which is great. They released an LP of his speeches, his racist speeches from the film. At the same time, hippies were queuing to watch the movie and shouting at him and threatening him. And it's recorded in one magazine. They were sort of shouting, "We're coming to get you, Joe." So it was really unsettled time. And there's a generational division. I mentioned earlier parallels were now. We could talk about culture wars because there's something very similar going on. So it is unsettled. And who's the bad guy in this? We used to have the Native American, a sort of mythological figure that represent the wilderness that needed to be tamed. And we've lost that. They tried it with the Vietnamese and that doesn't work. And you look at some of the political discourse about Vietnam, it's very similar. They talk about it in a sort of frontiers. And it's West, isn't it? We're going West and we're going to, civilize these people, as they say in a movie. And they talked about the new frontier with space. But it turns out there's nothing up there. And it's really expensive. So if you defined yourself by your expansionism, what happens when you've got nowhere else to expand to?
There's a couple of things I want to talk about to kind of think about how this might relate to after 1976 and after the book finishes. What's the reception to these films at the time?
At the time, it depends on the movie, but generally speaking, I would have said alarmist, particularly about Straw Dogs, Dirty Harry and Death Wish. Those movies were very much worried about, in terms of what it meant, in terms of what the audience would do after watching these movies, the idea that they were having some sort of negative effect, that and particularly that they were pushing fascism. I mean, Pauline Kael describes Straw Dogs as the first American film that can be considered a fascist work of art. Okay, that's interesting. Why do you think that? Kael's interesting because she absolutely hated anything Eastwood did ever. So she had a very dim view, but other people did, Roger Ebert, fairly mainstream critics, more accessible critics did as well. Joe was interesting because Joe was sort of half celebrated and half panicked about. And Peter Boyle, it made Peter Boyle a star. He's actually slightly miscast because he's far too young for the role, but he's there anyway. He's good in it. But he went around doing interviews saying, "I'm really not like this person. I'm a nice guy, really." And his character, interestingly, in Taxi Driver almost feels like a sort of intertextual reaction that playing off Joe and saying that he's a nice liberal guy, really. Straw Dogs really panicked people. It really upset British critics because they didn't like the depiction of Cornwall, which is kind of funny. But the British critics, and I in the book, I compare the British critics to the US critics because they're an interesting counterpoint, is the British critics worry about violence, but they don't worry about the ideology at all. They don't think these films are fascist. They don't think that this is the signs of, America turning into some sort of fascist state. They just think these are cracking but violent pieces of entertainment.
Do you think that where we didn't have access to guns?
I think, yeah, absolutely. I think also the crime rate here, although it did go up, it didn't go up anywhere near the scale that it was going up in America in the 60s and 70s. We talked about New York earlier and the chaos of New York as well. But, you're having huge riots, throughout the 60s, whether they're student riots or race riots, the Watts riots, for instance, in Los Angeles. So the immediacy of violence, particularly on the Western and Eastern seaboards, is very, very high in the US. In a way that it isn't here, although there is a moral panic about mugging and there's Daily Mail articles and Sun articles and stuff. So it's not that we didn't have it. And I do talk about Stuart Hall's books, Policing the Crisis, which draws on that and talks about that because there are parallels. But yeah, we don't have access to guns on the scale that Americans do. So the idea that you just go and buy a six shooter and get on a tube train and shoot somebody, well, that's unlikely here, thank God. and still is. But yeah, that, and of course the place of guns in the sort of myth of America is also quite complicated as well.
Maybe that reference to shooting people on the subway train, maybe that brings us on to that, the idea of it. Bernard Goetz?
Bernard Goetz.
Tell the listeners about that and what your thoughts are and how you connect that to the films that you refer to, if you make a connection at all. Was that 1980?
It was a bit later than that. I can date it exactly because there's a quote I will mention from Michael Winner in a second. It's 1985, I think. Bernard Goetz, mild-mannered, youngish, 30s-ish guy. Younger, that's because I'm 40-odd, so I think that's young, but you know what I mean. Middle-aged guy. He's on the subway. He says he's accosted by some young black men, three or four of them, one of whom has a screwdriver as a weapon. He pulls out a gun, he shoots them, kills a couple, paralyzes another. And in the 80s, this divides America. Is this man a racist killer, or is he just doing what everybody on the subway has wanted to do for years and years and years? Because the subway in America at that time was a pretty horrific place to be. People started to link it to Death Wish because he shoots people on the subway. Michael Winner, and if you forgive my swearing, said, if Bernard Goetz copied, he said something like, Bernard Goetz, if he copied Death Wish, well, it took 11 years and he's a fucking slow learner. Because that 11 years is quite, it's a facile comparison, but it's exactly the facile comparison that the press makes all the time. They kind of moved on to video games these days. You know, often you think about the school shootings, they'll draw attention to video games very quickly. They didn't draw attention to Bernie Goetz's home life. His dad was quite a successful man who then lost his job because he was sleeping with boys. So, you know, he was sexually assaulting them. They didn't talk about his mental health issues. They didn't talk about his behavior before or after. Everybody wanted to distill it into this simple narrative of either guy strikes back or, you know, guy shoots innocent black young men. Some of them had criminal records. It's more complicated. But there's this always this desire to create this binary opposition between, you know, it's one side or the other side. And this, you know, is a parallel with the current culture war, is everybody's either 100% this side or 100% over here. Maybe there's something a bit more nuanced sometimes going on in the center of things. But, you know, that doesn't sell newspapers. I mean, the other one, of course, is John Hinckley Jr., who shot President Reagan, who was obsessed with Taxi Driver. And he watched it numerous times, became obsessed with Jodie Foster, and for some reason thought shooting President Reagan was a good tribute to her. But, you know, mental health issues of that guy, massive. And also, so we have a man with huge mental health issues and he's able to just go and buy a gun. Okay, so it's more complicated than that. But then that ties into the discourses around should people be able to buy guns, all these sorts of things. So connecting things to... I'm very wary of the media effects arguments because sometimes they become so simplistic that I think it doesn't credit the audience with any brain. And, you know, you teach students and I do, and you talk to people, and actually people have some, you know, they can tell, they know they're watching a movie versus reality. They know what's going on there. Okay, yeah, there's some acts of disavowal as they watch a film. That's interesting. And I do talk about that in the book. But I think we have to credit people with some intelligence. But yeah, don't we bring up a movie, a violent movie or a violent video game every time somebody does something like this?
I suppose the facile comparisons that you talk about don't really stop. I mean, all the discourse around Joker 2 or 3 years ago, which is obviously, I mean, it was just unhinged in my opinion. And interestingly, it did parallel that, the scene with the Bernard Goetz as well, anyway, when he kills the three guys on the subway. And then the new Batman film, The Batman, has got a scene at the start where you've got people being mugged on a sub, or a guy almost gets mugged on a subway if it's not for the intervention of Batman. So that kind of iconography still resonates, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But fundamentally, it's there because American subways are pretty terrifying places. You know, it's like, if subways were nice, I don't think anybody's making these movies about Japanese subways, you know, because this isn't happening there. So it's a relation to that. My favorite one is a very subtle reference in Predator 2. There's a Predator scene in the subway, and there's a guy who looks quite a lot like Bernie Getz who pulls a gun out of the Predator. So it's a nice little bizarre little reference. But then, you know, Death Wish has a discourse about how the press reacts to the vigilante, and they bloody love him. They love Kersey's vigilante actions because, you know, and they engage in Western iconography. There's a Time magazine cover with a noose on it on a billboard to sort of, you know, push these things, because as much as some of the press like to condone it, you know, it shifts copies, doesn't it?
There's some interesting stuff in The Exterminator as well around the idea of the kind of hero worship of the vigilante. It all sorts of happens off screen in that film. It's a kind of film with some extraordinary narrative gaps. Right? But there's a scene where he's walking down the road and he's kind of getting mobbed outside of on 42nd Street. But you're not quite sure whether they know he's actually supposed to be the exterminator or not. It's a really odd movie in that respect. What? Tell me something, if you don't mind, about some of those films that came afterwards. You know, Driller Killer, The Exterminator, Miss 45. You know, you mentioned a little bit about them. I'm interested in this shift from what was the next generation, if you want, of these.
It's interesting because I don't touch them on in the book because I wanted to have that focusness on a small and really go deep into them. But, you know, we could talk about I Spit on Your Grave and the whole rape revenge cycle of movies, because, I mean, rape features in the movies I'm talking about quite heavily, but it's generally seen through the lens of the male characters, whereas, you know, I Spit on Your Grave, Miss 45, start to see it from the female point of view. And Abel Ferrara, of course, did Driller Killer as well. Look, whenever you have a successful A movie formula or a high budget formula, then the B movies, the Z movies will start to exploit them. Think about the Death Wish sequels. You know, the first movie, I am a defender of the first movie. I think it's way more nuanced and interesting than people have credited to it to. Whether that's because of or despite Michael Winner, that's up for debate. You look at the sequels and they become everything that the critics accuse the first one of being. Second one is a straight revenge film. He is searching for those people. It is way more exploitative, I would argue. The third one, actually, it's kind of brilliant, but it's mad, and it was all shot in London, and it kind of looks like it as well, and it's absurd, and becomes self-parodic. I think I'm trying to remember the name of the one with has got Linda Blair in it. Do you remember that? Savage Streets. You know, you get things like that, and they become more overtly, I guess, sexually exploitative, which is difficult. Not to say that Death Wish, the original, doesn't have elements of it, but they're kind of riffs on the ideas. They're a recycling, and that's not to say they're not interesting and that there's not interesting things going in, but these are basically low budget riffs. So The Exterminator kind of takes the idea of Taxi Driver, Vietnam vet returns home. It just whaps it up and adds a blowtorch because, you know, that's where we are. But there's an interesting cycle that happened about 20 years ago where we suddenly get high budget versions. We get The Brave One with Jodie Foster. And then since then, we've had the Equalizer movies. We've had a pretty poor Death Wish remake. So it's come back round again. And again, not that I want to parallel politics too much, but it's interesting that they have come round again as sort of A-list movies that will get Jodie Foster or Denzel Washington or Bruce Willis involved. Whereas that sort of canon movies cycle, I know they're not all canon movies, but I think that sums up canon, you know, the feel of them is that they're being pre-sold or they're being sold into international markets. And as long as you have a good chunk of violence and stuff as a filmmaker, you probably do some quite interesting subversive things perhaps, but we have to have, you know, probably a bit of violence every 10 minutes because that's the sort of audience that we're selling to. I was going to just say about Taxi Driver, because I'm interested to know what you think. One of the things I do question in the book is whether Travis Bickle is actually a Vietnam veteran, because the only person who says he is him, and he's psychotic. So do you think he is or not? Because it does establish that trope that, you know, Rolling Thunder, Exterminator, they all copy that.
I used to be a huge fan of Taxi Driver, and I still am. But it's just one of those films that I saw, you know, obviously when I was very, very young, and it was, you know, probably my favourite film for a long time when I was a teenager. It's not something I'd ever considered that he wasn't. So it's an interesting question. One thing I would say is that Paul Schrader based it on himself, right? So like Paul Schrader writes about his own life, and he wasn't a Vietnam veteran, right? So so I wonder why the Vietnam veteran element is in there. I don't know whether there's part of it. I'd have to go back. I do have the script. I'd have to go back and reread the script again. I know that Schrader was writing that. Scorsese was thinking about making another film, and De Niro was coming up with an idea of a film about a political assassination, and whether all these things kind of came together roughly around the same time, and whether some ideas were thrown in. I'd have to revisit the making of that, and it's probably been 20 years since I looked at
it. No, it just occurred to me because, you know, he tells us, and I've watched the movie a lot because you have to. And I sometimes wonder, it's like when he turns up with the mohawk and stuff, it's like if he wants to assassinate a political assassination in public, he's rubbish at this. And if he's a Marine, but he's unhinged, so that's your defense. But there's a return of the repressed idea coming into these films. And there's something I talk about with Dirty Harry. In fact, I think the first three Dirty Harry films can all be seen as reactions to Vietnam, which is not really talked about. Part of the problem with Dirty Harry's reaction at the time is everybody sees Scorpio as a hippie. And I'm like, I don't think he is. How many hippies have polished military boots, can put a sniper rifle together, shoot somebody from one building to the next building over, 200 yards or whatever it is? You know, this is a guy with military training. Or at least some sorts, you know, maybe not the literal military, but he's had training in this. He just has long hair. And later on in the film, he has a peace belt and stuff. I think you can read him as a Vietnam vet. And that's certainly something that Don Siegel thought you could do. And in the other two Dirty Harry films that came afterwards, Magnum Force and The Enforcer. Well, Magnum Force is about a worse vigilante group of cops. And they're all Vietnam vets. And there's some really interesting stuff about their sexuality in that movie. And then The Enforcer is a paramilitary terrorist group, very much like the one that kidnapped Patty Hearst, led by Vietnam vets, using guns that they steal from military bases. So there's I don't think anybody ever really thinks about the first three Dirty Harry films as sort of reactions to Vietnam, but I think they are, which is probably something I should write at some point.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And I'd always seen them as reactions to, like Magnum Force as a reaction to Dirty Harry.
Yeah.
You know, clearly. But it's a bizarre film, Magnum Force. It's like, you know, I might have seen it 20 times over the years, but I still never really get a sense of watching it from beginning to end. It's one of those films where it turns up on ITV4, whenever you switch it on halfway through, no matter what point you switch that film on, you're only 5 minutes away from a shootout of some kind.
Yeah. It feels, and I mean, I don't talk about it in the book because I wanted to look at Dirty Harry. In isolation, because if you start talking about the sequels, you start rewriting the original and you can get into all sorts of trouble. But look, Magnum Force is definitely a reaction, and it's to that criticism. And I mean, I talk about it a bit in the conclusion, because a lot of these films, you know, have sequels or rumored sequels. And Magnum Force definitely says, you thought Dirty Harry was bad, look at these guys. And then Harry looks tame by comparison, and they give him an Asian girlfriend as well. So you go, you thought he was a racist. He's not racist. He's sleeping with an Asian girl. It's okay. You know, we talked about the Death Wish sequels, the French Connection 2 as well. And there was going to be a sequel to Joe, but it never happened. Canon Films did announce Joe 2, but we never got it, sadly. But they announced a lot of films that never got made.
So, in terms of like the later cycle, then, would you say that this, you know, crisis in meaning, the lack of fixed narratives and grand narratives, that's just been maintained since the 1970s? We've never reverted
no.
that?
No, I think part of the reason the vigilante films becomes a B-movie genre in the 80s is because actually Reagan and the 80s settles America to a certain extent. And it's no coincidence that Reagan played cowboys. Reagan also comes in and refixes the other, and he makes the USSR the evil empire, and literally talks about it as the evil empire. There's no nuance or subtlety to this. These people must be stopped. So you see in the cop thriller, a lot of those films draw from Dirty Harry and the French Connection, particularly the Lethal Weapon, which really has elements riffing on that. Takes the burnt out Vietnam cop, but by the end actually kind of heals him. course, pairs him with a black partner. So we're healing race relations in America. And of course, the films I'm looking at, their race relations are really problematic. But, you know, Lethal Weapon, Die Hard as well. The black sidekick sort of comes in and sort of finds a place for those racial tensions to fit together. So mainstream Hollywood, I think, has a confidence in sort of the later 70s and the 80s that sort of resolve some of these things temporarily, but not permanently. And look, nowhere is this more encapsulated than 1976 when Rocky wins Best Picture over Taxi Driver. And, you know, I do quite like the Rocky films, but, you know, Taxi Driver artistically is a far more interesting film. But Rocky is a happy, optimistic film that gives us a white character that we can support. It's interesting that he is poor and not very bright, and his opponent is drawn as a much more sophisticated black man, which, you know, from a racial point of view, is interesting. I know that changes as the movies go on, but there is a sort of a, at least in mainstream Hollywood, a sense of sort of settledness in the 80s that perhaps disappears again later on, but it's definitely there. And I think, yeah, that's to do with Reagan, and that's to do with, again, otherness gets settled. We integrate all the groups that we weren't sure about, we start to put into our movies and we can be friends with. But you know, we have the evil empire. And of course, we rerun Vietnam and win it. You know, Rambo 2 is, you know, he just goes in and kills them all. He kills the Vietnamese, he kills the Russians. You have those Mission in Action films, the Chuck Norris movies that do the same thing. You have a lot of Vietnam veterans coming back and being healed. Okay, there's movies like Platoon that are doing other things, but, you know, for the big box office stuff, there's a real sense that actually we can solve these problems. I just, you know, long-term, as the news tells us, I probably didn't work very well.
So there's an element of reconciliation. Maybe the Buddy film maybe is quite interesting there.
Yeah.
There's a reconciliation. And they're mostly written by Shane Black, I suppose. So it's maybe just a variation on different things. But if you look at his films, he's got like Lethal Weapon with the kind of the black and white pairing. There's also an age, supposed to be an age difference in that film as well. And he does, I'm going off topic now, but The Long Kiss Goodnight, there's the female and the black man. And then you've also got in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is the gay.
Yeah, absolutely.
FBI and the Robert Downey Jr. character is a kind of slick, fast-talking kind of guy. So there's an element of reconciliation there. Amongst all that, I suppose, is Red Heat as well. So you've got the Walter Hill film where you've got the Russian cop and the American cop.
Yeah.
Who reconciled
as we're getting towards Glasnost and Perestroika and all these sorts of things.
About 1990, that film.
If you say so, I believe you. Yeah. No, it must be about that. I mean, of course, Rambo 3, which is brilliant because it's like fighting a war that's finished, and there's Rambo and the Taliban. I mean, it's amazing. And Living Daylights actually does something kind of similar, engages with that, and then it's sort of from this distance you think, well, that's politically a bit interesting from here.
Yeah, I think it's the Living Daylights. Yeah, absolutely. I suppose there's that sense of until the end when they turn up at the at the concert. I mean, at least they leave it with there's an uneasy alliance, right?
Yes,
between them.
Yeah, but it's kind of it's just funny at the end. You know, they're just you know, good guys. It's like, okay,
yeah. Tell me if you might not know these films. I mean, you'll have heard of them, but so if you don't, if you have nothing to say, don't force it. What's your thoughts on two Al Pacino films, Serpico and Cruising, which I think were two 70s movies where he plays a cop that's undercover? What's your thoughts on how they fit into what you're talking about?
They're parallels, and Serpico is one I actually really thought about, but fundamentally he kind of stays within the system and everybody's prosecuted. He just has an awful time doing it. Cruising I have not seen for a very long time, and that's a fascinating film, and that's one of those movies that is always going to be controversial. It was controversial when it was made, and I'm sure it is, and like I say, I haven't seen it in 20 odd years. But again, fundamentally, you know, I thought, does he get kicked out in Cruising, or does he stay part of the police?
No, he stays part of the policing.
Yeah. So he effectively stays within the structures. So we're not pushing out, you know, against the structures of law and order. We're problematizing them, and they're difficult, but we're fundamentally staying within them and saying, you know. But we are looking at the impact that those structures have and the damage that they do. And, you know, a surprising amount of sympathy for you know, some police officers against the backdrop of the sort of corruption of lots of other people.
The Eastwood film, Tightrope.
Yeah, that's...
always gets a giggle if anyone's seen that film whenever you mention it.
It does. It's later. What's that? It's early 80s, isn't it?
84, I think, Tightrope.
84. Look, I think Eastwood's brilliant. And it's something that I talk about, not so much in this book, but I talked about in the New Wave, New Hollywood book, is that Eastwood is a very reflexive performer very early on in his career. The other Dirty Harry comes out, the Beguiled comes out, and Play Misty for Me comes out. And actually, in the big Dirty Harry scene where he walks up and says the big speech for the first time, Play Misty for Me is on in the cinema in the background. That's actually there. This is a guy who interrogates his persona, and Tightrope absolutely does. And of course, later on, Gran Torino. Now that's a really interesting counterpoint, because that sets itself up as sort of, you know, old Dirty Harry, and then does something completely different and shows that a sort of more, I guess, more meditative, thoughtful Eastwood, perhaps. But Unforgiven, his Western's brilliant, and Unforgiven's an amazing film. And again, shows the limitations of violence, but I don't think Dirty Harry says, go out and shoot people. And that's kind of what I'm getting at. And I don't think, you know, I guess some of Eastwood's movies do, but he's always made weird choices. I mean, you think about the orangutan movies. They're bizarre. They are really weird movies. Nobody wanted to make the first one. They wanted to make the second one because they saw how much money the first one made. But for years, Any Which Way But Loose was his highest grossing film. It was more successful than Dirty Harry, more successful than anything else he made. You're like, how is that possible? But he understands the audience, and he understands the audience understand his persona, I think. And, you know, if you go back and watch a Rawhide episode, Rowdy Yates is the opposite of the man with no name. And the persona, again, he's playing. He studies himself. He plays off against himself, and then he does it again and again. So he gives the audience kind of what they want, but then plays with it. And he's a really interesting case study of aging as well with an action star. We talk about Jerry action movies, which is such a good word. I wish I'd come up with it. But, you know, he was doing that with things like In the Line of Fire. So he's always been discussing and counterpointing. But Tightrope, I haven't seen for years, but it's a great movie, I think. Is it a good movie?
My understanding of what a good movie is and what a good movie isn't is a lot broader than other people. So, I mean, if I like it, I say it's a good movie. That's all.
Yeah, that's good enough for me. Yeah, I haven't seen it in a while. And I remember I was okay with it, a little disappointed with it. But sometimes you have to revisit things because, you know, it's not necessarily what you think it's going to be. And then you revisit and think, okay, this is pretty damn clever. But that happened to The Beguiled when it came out. I mean, it was advertised as a Western. And then you watch it and go, this is not what this movie is much more interesting than that.
So what would it be fair to say, just as we wrap up, that this kind of end of the grand narrative, the crisis in meaning, it spreads across genres, it spreads across Hollywood, in American cinema, but this focus on the kind of urban vigilante film really crystallizes the problems. Is it because it's just a tight core of movies?
Yes, absolutely. And they're really engaging with the issues of particularly law and order, but that's partly the crisis of meaning. We don't know who the good guys and the bad guys are, which is the otherness thing, to the point where the good guys look like the bad guys and the bad guys look like the good guys. I actually start the book talking about a guy called Arvel Garland, and it's a quotation about him. And he's very much like the character of Joe. He's a real figure, 1970. He goes to his daughter's university dorm, shoots her, and shoots two of her friends. And he does this because he hates her hippie lifestyle. People decried him because he'd murdered people. People sent him money and said, thank you for doing what we would like to do. Because, you know, there's this speech in Joe where he talks about the kids, they just shit on us. They shit on everything. That's what's going on. We don't know what's right and wrong. Garland, is he a hero? Is he a villain? I mean, he murdered his daughter. He's a villain. But the fact that people didn't think that is kind of what's going on, because the soup of morality, the soup of the death of the grand ideas is happening, and the upheavals. Yeah, absolutely.
Kerry, thanks very much for coming on to talk about your book. I really appreciate you giving me the time.
No worries. It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks again to Dr. Kerry Edwards. His book, The Vigilante Thriller, Violence, Spectatorship and Identification in American Cinema from 1970 to 1976, is now available from Bloomsbury. And also, thanks to you for listening. Newton Talks will return.